Welcome back to the Imagination Redeemed podcast, a podcast of the Anselm Society. I'm Brooke McIntyre, and today I'm excited to share with you about this month's theme at the Anselm Society, which is cultivation. Cultivation is a lost art for a lot of us. It requires paying attention and understanding each person and thing in its proper way. It requires love, requires viewing everything as the Creator does, so not just as it is, but as it can grow to be. And it requires seeing ourselves not as a scourge upon nature, but as agents of blessing. We're going to dive deeper into this, but first I wanted to remind you all of our upcoming Imagination Redeemed Conference, which is happening at the end of this month in Colorado Springs on September 30th and October 1st. You can get tickets and find out more at our website, which is anselmsociety.org. So as I mentioned, this month's theme is cultivation, and we asked Gracie Olmsted to contribute this month's essay. Gracie Olmsted is a journalist who focuses on farming, community, and place. Her writing has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, The Week, and the Weekly Standard, among others, and she is the author of Uprooted, Recovering the Legacy of the Places We've Left Behind, which is a part memoir, part journalistic look at questions of place, history, rootedness, habits, and cultivation. So let me read to you Gracie Olmsted's essay on cultivating and relearning how to create. Every spring at our old farmhouse in Virginia, a pair of finches would nest in the hanging plant I placed on our porch. As soon as I hung it outside in April, they took over, rummaging about to find the perfect spot for their eggs, nibbling off strands of petunia vine, slowly adding bits of found objects from the garden and the yard to their creation. As I watered the plant through the spring, the finch parents would watch me warily from a nearby tree branch. I peeked inside their nest, careful not to dampen it, and saw their fragile eggs inside. Eventually, I would see hatched baby birds nestled together, sleepy-eyed. Together, year after year, these finches and I sought to provide a safe spot for these baby birds to grow and hatch. Our shared spring rhythm was oriented around patterns of nesting and nest protecting that sought to nurture life. A rhythm, I would argue, embedded in the creation story itself. In the second verse of Genesis, we read of the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters. The verb, merahefet, in this sentence, often translated as hover, can also mean brooded, referring to a mother bird brooding over her young, as it does in Deuteronomy 32:11. What mysterious gentleness exists, then, in God's acts of creation? The act of bringing order from chaos emerges as a powerful work of the Holy Spirit, one forged in the immense tenderness we associate with a bird that is nesting. In the fragility of life, in its tenuousness, God is present, and the cultivation of life happens in and through love's enclosing of this fragility. In considering the creation mandate in Genesis, this essay considers what it means for humans to participate in God's work of cultivation. The word cultivate comes from the Latin cultiva, which refers to the tilling of land, and colere, to till, to inhabit, to frequent, practice, respect, tend, guard. As the various meanings of colere indicate, the term cultivation encompasses something more than tilling and planting. It suggests habits of constancy, care, and stewardship. We can only forge these habits, I argue, in and through the creative, life-nurturing love of God. Love embodied in tactile objects and life forms, and in care for these objects and life forms. We are all called to nest in this world. Alas, this is a work we have often done poorly or not at all throughout human history. Humans have often interpreted the commands in Genesis 1:28 to subdue and to have dominion according to our interests and greed. In a framing of the creation mandate that justifies exploitation of God's creatures and earth, humans position themselves not in harmony with, but in opposition to plant and animal life on the earth. In our efforts to bring order to wild places, we destroy as much or more than we create. In our agricultural efforts to subdue the soil, we denude it and spray it with chemicals. And in our creative efforts, from the creation of smartphones to the cultivation of plastics, we create disastrous amounts of waste. We live not in harmony with our ecosystems, but at war with them. In Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, a character named Father Zosima tells the story of his brother Markel, who died as a teenager. As he became ill, Markel experienced a remarkable conversion to Christianity. Some of his last words, related by Father Zosima, are captured thus, again drawing our eyes to birds in a garden. The windows of his room looked out into the garden, and our garden was a shady one, with old trees in it which were coming into bud. The first birds of spring were flitting in the branches, chirping and singing at the windows. And looking at them and admiring them, he began suddenly begging their forgiveness too. "Birds of heaven, happy birds, forgive me, for I have sinned against you too." None of us could understand that at the time, but he shed tears of joy. "Yes," he said, "there was such a glory of God all about me, birds, trees, meadows, sky. Only I lived in shame and dishonored it all and did not notice the beauty and glory." "You take too many sins on yourself," Mother used to say, weeping. "Mother, darling, it's for joy, not for grief, I am crying. Though I can't explain it to you, I like to humble myself before them, for I don't know how to love them enough." Markel here defines sin, not just against our fellow humans, but against the world itself, in a way few others have managed to elucidate. We are surrounded by God's glory, and amid that glory, we have not loved enough. Psalm 104 speaks of God's active nurturing of the earth. He touches the earth, waters the mountains, renews the ground, feeds his creatures, and takes away their breath. We, in contrast, have been sleepwalkers, dulled to the vibrant life of the world God has made. Because of our lack of care, we transgress against God, the humans made in his image, and the creatures he has wrought in love. But Markel also offers a definition of love that speaks to the rhythms of cultivation this chapter is meant to highlight. He suggests slightly earlier in this passage that we must glorify life in our work, play, lament, and care for the world. The right ordering of our work of cultivation must be forged in and through Markel's joyful grief and attentive humility, through the process of realizing how much more we must love. The creation mandate emerges as the creative effort to contribute to a flourishing world, as Norman Wirzba writes in This Sacred Life, an effort in which we tenderly care for human and non-human life. This is, in a sense, starting at the end with an acknowledgement of our brokenness, of our failure to cultivate and to love God's creation as we ought. It's important, therefore, to now turn back to the beginning to consider how God displays colere in the mythic rhythms of the creation account and how the creation mandate is both more exciting and more challenging than we often realize. In Genesis 1:28, God tells Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." The first aspect of this command, in its focus on a proliferation of life, emphasizes our role as sub-creators. Our lives should be full of life in the bearing and tending of children, in our service to the church, and in the fostering of vibrant communities. To be fruitful is to participate in patterns of creation and caregiving God has fostered all throughout his world. This will mean, for many Christians, having babies and raising children. For others, it will include mentorship and caregiving roles amid singleness or childlessness. For each of us, it involves habits of care for the earth, cultivating practices that fill our communities and ecosystems with life and health, embodying the virtues and truths we hold dear. It also involves creating things that mirror God's artistry. In Psalm 104, which I quoted earlier in this chapter, Our capacity for creativity in response to God's blessing and provision is referenced in verses 14 and 15. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. Here, God provides for human and non-human life alongside each other. But whereas the nourishment of cattle is primary and unmediated, our nourishment has intrinsic creative and artistic implications. We do not just tend plants from the ground, we also, by the grace of God, can transform and order them in creative ways. In, for instance, wine, oil, and bread. All these examples highlight the diverse, multitudinous, and relational colere work we are called to as image bearers. The verbs subdue and dominion in the creation mandate have troubled many writers and thinkers, however, as they seem to justify the violence and destruction we see in the age of the Anthropocene. This emphasizes the importance of reading Genesis 1:28 with an understanding of the Spirit's work of Merehefet. As we are made in the image of God, our works of creation and cultivation are meant to mirror His own. The creation mandate, therefore, must point toward the gentleness and tenderness of God's creative work, not away from it. The Hebrew word translated as subdue here, kabash, implies an ordering and replenishing without violence or cruelty. It suggests instead a gentle work, one that echoes God's own nurturing rhythms throughout Genesis 1. It affirms humanity's active participation in God's work of nesting and enfolding, protecting and cherishing. We too can brood in this earth, nurturing it, loving it, ordering it, and seeking its good. In considering Genesis' pattern of cultivation and creation, it's important to note that things are not just ordered, they are ordered in relation to each other. God creates ecosystems, webworks of life that illustrate His own relational nature as a triune God. We as humans are not called to autonomy and isolation, but to live within relationships. Things on earth live and move and have their being in Christ, and in mirroring the Trinity in and through interdependence. Everything is ordered in love and relationality. Creation's biological arrangement thus conveys the heart of the gospel, the Trinitarian love at the center of all things. This love connects us to our fellow humans. We are our brother's keepers, and it connects us to the non-human life around us. This sort of ecosystem-focused cultivation is exemplified in the Year of Jubilee and the practice of Shemitah, explicated in Leviticus 25. God commanded the Israelites to let the land lie fallow every seventh year. This was also a time in which slaves would be freed and debts would be canceled. During this fallow period, the soil could repair itself. Perennial plants could grow. Wildlife could receive needed shelter and sustenance. Even groundwater could be impacted by deep-rooted systems encouraged through the practice. Shemitah suggests to us the grace and love inherent in the creation mandate, as humans are called not to consume, but to steward God's creatures and plants' life. Here, to subdue is not to endlessly control, domineer, or oppress God's earth. Rather, it is to seek the harmony and the flourishing of the land, its shalom. Neither is it about cultivating more profit in ensuing seasons, like many modern sustainability techniques. In an interview, farmer Lucy Zigward suggested that what sets Shemitah apart from a typical crop rotation is that it invites us to reimagine our fundamental relationship with the land. Shemitah is a full stop, reset, rethink of cultivation. Like the practice of leaving food in the field corners for the needy, the Year of Jubilee suggests that the human rulership of the earth can only be realized in habits of love and care. In examples such as these, a subduing work is forged in rhythms of humility, in an acknowledgement of the intricate complexity inherent in God's created order. The rhythms of the ecosystems God created are poetic, interlinking, and overlapping, creating a web or meshwork of life, as anthropologist Tim Ingold puts it. To be proper cultivators of the earth, therefore, requires our patient attention and our wonder. The intricacy and depth of God's creations defy scientific explanation or human mastery. This is something mothers and fathers often realize with time. No matter how many months we spend caring for our children, and no matter how many children we have, each day of parenting surprises us. To care for God's unique created beings requires constant trust that He will show us how we should cherish them. We obey the creation mandate, not through hubris, but through a humble awareness of our insufficiency. As Wendell Berry writes in A Native Hill, "We must change our lives so that it will be possible to live by the contrary assumption that what is good for the world will be good for us. And that requires that we make the effort to know the world and to learn what is good for it. We must learn to cooperate in its processes and to yield to its limits. But even more important, we must learn to acknowledge that the creation is full of mystery. We will never entirely understand it. We must abandon arrogance and stand in awe. We must recover the sense of the majesty of creation and the ability to be worshipful in its presence. For I do not doubt that it is only on the condition of humility and reverence before the world that our species will be able to remain in it." As we attend to the world around us in a spirit of humility, we will see, like Marquille, that we have not loved enough. This realization prompts lament as well as reverence, but I would posit that the more time we spend in embodied acts of creation and care, gardening, raising children, building furniture, baking bread, or caring for animals, for instance, the more we are prompted to praise, reciting God's words of benediction and love in Genesis 1, declaring the goodness of this world and its creator. We all yearn, I think, to live life in harmony with nature, no longer striving against thorns. It is what we were made for, after all. In Christ, we see the patterns of stewardship, ordering, and care that draw the whole earth to shalom. As a carpenter, Jesus himself would have engaged in artistic acts of subcreation, shaping wood into both beautiful and useful objects for human flourishing. In turning water into wine, multiplying loaves and fishes, and calming storms, he demonstrates his power over all creation, and he exercises this power in a way that blesses and nurtures life. In his Sermon on the Mount, he emphasizes God's care for the birds and the lilies, adding that we are of much more value than the birds. In Jesus' tender attention to little children, widows, and the sick, he patterns the calere work we must replicate. The earth flourishes through his presence, his touch. In the life of Christ, we finally see what it would look like to notice God's beauty and glory in his creation and to love enough. The Gospels draw our voices to sing and our hearts to delight. We live in a world broken by the fall. Because of this, we don't always know how to cultivate fruitfulness or how to reckon with the evil and brokenness around us. How do we respond to pestilence and famine, injustice and violence? J.R.R. Tolkien's character Tom Bombadil from The Lord of the Rings is inspiring in this regard, not because he offers solutions to our specific problems, but because he exemplifies a specific way of being. He overflows with song and poetry, and his life is centered around works of cultivation and creation. Whether in preparing food and drink for his guests, yellow cream, honeycomb, and white bread and butter, carrying home water lilies for his beloved goldberry, or intending to his forest home. But Tom also shows us how to reckon with fallenness and darkness. He does not fight off evil with viciousness or pride, but with persistent and joyful efforts to tune the world to its proper key. When Frodo cries out for help in the old forest, Tom comes to his rescue. He tells Frodo that he knows the tune to sing to Old Man Willow, a tune that can, if necessary, sing his roots off, or sing a wind up and blow leaf and branch away. Tom responds to evil not with fear, but with the unwavering resolve of one who sees himself as a ruler of the forest, responsible for all the life it contains. His home also serves as a refuge, a place of resilience, community, and love, amid darkness. Tom shows us what it means to subdue and to create in a broken world, how to love, steward, and tend without ruthlessness. We are unlikely to meet and do battle with sinister willows, but we will meet pernicious forces in our world. We may also live in environments that, like Tom's, seem dark and depressing, beyond hope. In the face of these challenges, we can embrace the rhythms of colere, its patterns of constancy, love, and fidelity. We can ask that God would tune our hearts aright, and that He would give us words and ways that replenish the world He has made. We can build homes that serve as puddles of heaven in a broken world. To subdue becomes an opportunity to mirror God's work in fostering life-giving, relational systems of flourishing. The creation mandate's vision of colere could apply to the way we design cities, run hospitals, plant and tend our gardens, cook, clean, or parent our children. In all such instances, the call to cultivate demands the tender care demonstrated in the life of Christ, ministering to tangible, embodied needs in and throughout a creation, supporting the proliferation and flourishing of God's webwork of life. In supporting that web, we realize that the voices of nature, as St. Augustine suggests in Confessions, are constantly testifying to God's preeminence. "But what is my God?" I put my question to the earth. It answered, "I am not God, and all the things on earth declare the same. I asked the sea and the chasms of the deep and the living things that creep in them, but they answered, 'We are not your God. Seek what is above us.' I spoke to the winds that blow, and the whole air and all that lives in it replied, 'Anaximenes is wrong. I am not God.' I asked the sky, the sun, the moon, and the stars, but they told me, 'Neither are we the God whom you seek.' I spoke to all the things that are about me, all that can be admitted by the door of the senses, and I said, 'Since you are not my God, tell me about him. Tell me something of my God.' Clear and loud they answered, 'God is he who made us.'" All God's creation, the psalmist reminds us, declares the glory of God. George MacDonald elucidates this similarly in one of his sermons, in which he writes, "All nature, from the mountains to the sea to the fog that hangs so low on the hills, the heather in August, the hot, the cold, the rain, everything speaks, like the flower, messages from God, the Father of the universe." The work of cultivation is thus part and parcel of our calling to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. When we embrace the creation mandate, the lives we cultivate join in a universal chorus. We are no longer out of tune, sleepwalking, unaware of the glory all about us, but listening to and joining in these voices. We participate in a universal song of praise and take our place in the magnificent dance of the cosmos. Therefore, friends, let us follow Markiel's advice to go straight into the garden, walk and play there, love, appreciate, and kiss each other, and glorify life.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Anselm Society in Colorado Springs. Our mission is a renaissance of the Christian imagination. We exist to help Christians remember who they are, to cultivate a deep awareness of their relationship to the great story, and to bring that awareness home to their families and churches. To find out more about us or to become a patron, please visit AnselmSociety.org. Thanks for listening.